You're listening to Shop Talk with your host, Kevin Tates. Brought to you by Eastwood Tools. Everything you need to do the job right.
Thanks for listening to Shop Talk. I'm Kevin Tates, and we are rushing headlong into another awesome season of working on and enjoying our beasts of burden, our projects and restorations. Good weather is coming soon. I can feel it. And with that comes the process of dragging out your tools and equipment and getting ready to get your hands dirty again. So keep an eye on Eastwood for some great sales and great discounts on the tools and equipment you need for your project. And email us at Shop Talk, because we're giving out hefty discounts if your question is read during the show. Today's guest is Mark Lambert, a name you may have heard since he's been a host on the DIY Network Classic Car Restoration Show, as well as a judge at Pebble Beach Concours events, and has certainly been around the block enough to earn his stellar reputation of a restoration expert with a truckload of integrity. Mark and I get into a great discussion about where the hobby is going and a philosophy of how to communicate with customers if you're a small business or shop owner. Very interesting stuff, so listen up. This is Mark Lambert on Shop Talk. Hey, gearheads, you're listening to Shop Talk, brought to you by the Eastwood Company. Do the job right with Eastwood. Our conversation today is with a man who has a deep-rooted history in the automotive restoration hobby and industry. You may know his name from his three seasons on the DIY Network hosting Classic Car Restoration, or from some of the publications he's been spotlighted in, or perhaps if you've ever attended a Pebble Beach Concours, you may have seen him walk in the show field with a notepad in hand, judging some of the world's finest automobiles. This is Mark Lambert. Mark, how are you, man?
Kevin, I'm doing great. It's such a pleasure to join you on Shop Talk. Thank you very much for asking me to join you.
Oh, well, thanks for taking the time out of your schedule. And trust me, people, if you look up busy schedule, it's got Mark Lambert's picture at the bottom of it.
I'm actually at the shop right now, and my hands are still a little dirty from a 36 Packard, so I'm wiping them as we talk.
Well, that's fantastic. I love the fact that you've got dirt under your fingernails and such a sense of class and style about you. It's awesome. It's a great dichotomy.
Well, Kevin, that's likewise, and I want to say at the top of this thing, I really have just had such pleasure watching you and your trajectory of your career, because you're one of those rare guys that knows all of this side of it, how to run a shop, how to fix a car, how to restore a car, but you also have this whole media thing figured out. You've been able to navigate how to sort of control that in a certain way so that you can get the message out there to our listeners and readers worldwide. And that's just really rare. There's a lot of people in media that do car stuff, but in my opinion, and I've brushed up against this a little bit, many of them are more on the actor side. They really aren't very comfortable underneath a car and in a shop nearly as much as guys like you or myself or any of the other guys that run shops would be. So it really reads that way, and thank you so much for all the help over the years.
Well, those are wonderful, great, nice things to say, and I'm humbled by that, Mark, and I appreciate it. Why don't we just turn this around, and you just go ahead and interview me.
Let's do it. I've actually got some education questions, so great.
All right, man. That's awesome stuff. Well, listen, let's acquaint some of our listeners with Mark Lambert. Tell us how you got involved. You've got a family tie that's very strong. Tell us about your childhood in the automotive hobby.
I do, Kevin, and I was just so blessed to be part of this big automotive family. I grew up in a great car town, Indianapolis, Indiana, mm-hmm. sort of the hotbed of a lot of early automobile engineering. You know, for a while there were a lot of cars being made in Indianapolis, and to grow up there was just so great, and to be involved in it from a very early age. You know, we were encouraged as kids to really jump into cars and motorcycles and mini bikes, but I was more interested in cars than anything else personally.
Well, that's
That's pretty obvious by some of the photographs that you've given me. And people that are listening, if you go to the Eastwood website, you can click on a couple of these photos and take a look at Mark and his early childhood and wonderful old cars and race cars. Tell me about the race cars.
Well, that was a shop up in Kokomo, Indiana, that my grandfather started in the early 20s. It was just a way to kind of pursue a more exciting part of running a junkyard and a used car lot. They would build race cars and race them on the weekends. And he got so involved with it, he was pretty instrumental in the Central States Racing Association. And they would put on races. He became a race, not only a builder, but a promoter. And, you know, my dad growing up in that whole atmosphere of working on cars all week to make the race on the weekend, and my grandmother running the concession stand, and
wow.
Everybody just going full bore toward a race really had a lot of bearing on my direction and a few of my brother's directions.
Well, it's you were exposed to competition, but kind of being family oriented. Speaking of competition, you were a competitive swimmer. When did that start for you, Mark?
I was that also, Kevin. I got really interested in swimming when I was just a kid, about 5 or 6 years old. Competitive swimming is a little known world to outsiders. It's not a spectator sport. It's a sport, a very individual kind of sport that encourages hard work and discipline. I mean, it takes a lot of determination and a lot of, self-discipline to make that happen. And it's all to compete on the weekends, very much like automobile racing.
Well, that's kind of why I asked that, because it all sort of ties in. And do you think that those formative years in swimming taught you a work ethic that arguably you absolutely have to have it to be in the restoration world? And people listening know this as well. You've got to have that self-discipline. So do you think your swimming helped you with that?
Very much so, yeah. It was probably the single most sort of character-building thing that a young person can do, get involved in an individual sport like that. Not necessarily a team sport, although I've just never been part of a team sport. I'm sure that they work out great for a lot of kids, but individual sports sort of in an aggressive way, they sort of push the responsibility onto the individual. I can't blame anybody else if I swim slow.
Exactly. You can't blame the clock either.
No. And the other thing it teaches, Kevin, is an understanding of physics. You know, input equals output. If the more I put in and the more science that I think about the way I put into it, the energy and the science, the better the outcome, the faster the swim. It's very much like any other kind of racing or competition. You don't only think about the self-discipline, because anybody can get in and thrash. You also have to think about the science of it, the physiology of it.
Well,
the physics
water flow,
involved.
Water dynamics, hydrodynamics, aerodynamics, everything factors in, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and it's like in any other type of atmosphere, only more. You know, as speed increases in water, resistance is cubed.
So, do you still swim today?
I swim today. Yes, I swim.
You did.
I swim 5-6 days a week when I'm in town, and things are going my way. I still get in pretty often. So,
it's
a big part of the day. I usually leave the shop sometime midday for a couple of hours and grab a couple thousand yard swim and some food and get back in the shop. And it just kind of clears my mind. You know how important that is. And it also keeps you sort of fit vertically. You know, you need a place when you're in the restoration business. You need a way to get away from the shop and move in other directions. It's an extremely physical job, but you're bent over a lot.
Yeah.
And you need to get vertical, and you need to, you know, maintain your posture. All of these things are so important for you young guys that are just getting into this later in life. Think about this stuff. It's so easy to just ignore it early on, and you really pay the price later if you don't take care of the most important machine, and that's your own body.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well said. Well, people that may not know you, they don't know that you live in Nashville. How long have you lived in Nashville, and when did you open your shop?
I moved here, actually, for the second time, Kevin. I moved here in 1985, and that sort of stuck. I came here for a short time in the early 80s when I was in the corporate world, and I really enjoyed the town. It's a great car town for this part of the nation. And then I had a chance to move back permanently in 85, and I did, and I opened my shop right away. And I joke with close friends that, you know, I was 3 weeks behind work a week into it. I couldn't believe how much work there is here. And you know, it sounds sort of arrogant in a way to say that, you know, like I'm so good or something. It's not that at all. There's just a lot of business out there. There's a lot of work out there. And if you position yourself in front of it, this is another important aspect of this. You younger guys that are thinking about doing this and opening a shop or going in any direction business-wise, take a good long look at the strategy of your business and make sure that you position yourself in front of a wave of work or business. And then it'll wash over you and carry you in all the directions you want to go. Don't try to fight it and look for water. Go where the water is.
Exactly. And as long as I've known you, Mark, I don't think I've ever seen any kind of a lack of something to do at Lambert's Garage. I think you've
always had stuff to do.
Covered up.
Well, on the back side of that, Kevin, of course, it's easy to snow me under because I'm one guy. But I like to pick and choose, and you know, never be hesitant to turn a job away that just doesn't feel right.
You know, I'm glad you're bringing that up, and that all falls into the thing that I wanted to bring up next, which is valuing your time. And it's especially important for people coming into this. And we'll talk about this topic a little bit later on as well. But for guys, I've known people that are fantastic craftsmen that don't value their labor hour. And it's a shame. It sets you teach people how to treat you is one of my favorite statements. And
yes,
if you have the luxury of putting yourself, like you say, in front of that wave of work, then you can elevate your labor rate to make sure that you're not only making money so you can help other people, but that you can pay the bills and you don't have to undervalue your time. And to me, that's just an important part of setting up your business in the first place. Am I right?
You are. It's exactly right. It's something that people need to remember in this business. This work is important. There's not many people that can do it. There's fewer even that can do it right. So,
well, and there's always somebody that wants to pay you less than what it's worth. And
yes,
I made the mistake.
Yeah.
I opened a little restoration shop in 1993, and I nearly worked myself to death. I was a one-man show, just like you are, and I was so intent on getting my name out there and, you know, putting great quality work out at affordable prices that I nearly shot myself in the foot. As a matter of fact, I barely made money doing that, and it was a huge lesson for me. Not that you want to charge somebody or gouge somebody, but you have to value yourself, and I've learned that lesson the hard way.
Well, that's a beautiful thing, Kevin. That's called the market.
Yes.
People, that's the buyer's job. The buyer's job is to buy at the lowest possible price, and the seller's job is to sell at the highest possible price. And
right,
we choose to get together. I just make a choice to run at the top of the market. That's where I want to be. I don't want to be at the bottom of the market. I only want to deal with the guys that really can afford their cars. You know, I've had this conversation over the years with customers, personal call, and describe their goals. And I'll say, well, what's your time frame and what's your budget? And they'll explain it to me. And I say, well, there's really one strategy here. And, of course, they're on the edge of the chair saying, oh, you know, what's he going to say? you need to sell your car. you need to get into, you know, show dogs or polka dancing or something. You know, sell your car to somebody that can afford it, because you can't. You're stuck in 1973 prices here. You can't paint a car for $3,000. You can't even pull the windshield out and the doors apart for $3,000.
Well, have you ever had somebody get upset with you for putting things like that?
Yeah. But again, it's a beautiful mechanism because they leave.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Or they begin to listen. You get their attention.
Guys listening, trust me when I say Mark Lambert is not an egotistical person. He's so humble and so gracious and brutally honest. And that's what you're hearing is honesty. But it's not just honesty with the customer. It's honesty with himself. Mark knows what he knows how to do, which his skill set is vast. I know what I know how to do, and I know how to charge for my labor as well. And when you meet that right customer, if you're in business, then there's synergy there. There's a gelling that happens, and you have a beautiful relationship with the person that understands the value of your time, where you understand the value of their commitment. And Mark has stumbled upon this many, many times and literally lives by that philosophy. So it's wonderful being in your shadow, my friend.
Well, you're very kind, but you're so correct, Kevin. It's so important to convey the most amount of information in a way that people can understand, and sometimes that takes some fairly blunt language.
And there's always that. You know, I had a conversation with Chip Foose. It was a couple of years ago, and we were talking about this very same thing and the philosophy and the communication between customers. And a lot of guys that are in his position, they'll take an escrow account and work off of that escrow, meet with the customer, or past a certain dollar point, you call them clients or something like that. But you work up into a goal, and then you discuss. And then you reset the goals, and then you work up into the goal. And what coincides with those goals is the budget. And that way, everybody's on the same page. Everybody's happy. So it's a beautiful philosophy to not losing your butt.
Yes. Communication, efficient communication is just absolutely key to success in life. You've got to know how to communicate with people. A large part of communicating is listening. That's all. But, learning this stuff takes a long time, and listening well helps. But, just growing up around people that were in this business and having a father that whose idea of a fun time was loading us into the car and going over to the west side of downtown Indianapolis and looking at the decrepit, decaying Duesenberg factory. That was our idea of a nice Saturday.
Yeah.
You're walking
around,
there's, pigeons flying around everywhere, going over the Stutz building, and really getting an early education on how vibrant this city was and how important it was to the building of the automobile industry and to this country, and the amazing minds that were, living there in Indianapolis, the Carl Fisher, the Indianapolis Speedway, and all the history out there is just incredible.
So do you think that this baptism at an early age into the history of classic cars shaped you in your interest into your field of expertise?
Well, it did, but I chased it too. I mean, there's a lot of discussion today about young people in the hobby, and I think a lot of people are sort of selling the youth short in being so concerned about this. If you think about the facts involved and what we know about the past, we know that the expensive cars today, the most valuable cars today, are being collected by people that weren't even born when they were in service.
Mm-hmm.
So how did they learn that stuff? Well, they went out and pursued it. They didn't have a bunch of guys come in and sort of force them to try to learn something or telling that all cars are significant. And an old car is just, any old car is a classic car. What nonsense. You're not doing anybody any service by telling a young person that every car is significant, because it's not.
Right.
You should, if they ask, you should teach them why one is more significant than the other, why one would be more valuable, why one would deliver a certain experience and another one a different experience.
Well, and in that discovery and in that learning curve, you can develop passion and kind of fine-tune and hone, I guess, a specific group of interest, I guess.
Yes, but the point that I was trying to make, is, and I'm failing at doing it, I'm afraid, is that young people that are interested in this and they have an innate interest in it may or may not be from car families. I mean, I had a lot mm-hmm. of breaks early on, but I had very close friends who are still close friends today that grew up in families that couldn't care less about cars.
Right.
But they're so involved in cars today. So I think when you've got the bug, you're going to pursue this thing. Now that's when to keep your eyes open. When the kid kind of sheepishly walks into your shop and, you know, he's kind of got his head down and he's a little embarrassed, but he just can't stay away. And he says, "Gee, I'm just so enthralled with these cars," in his own way, in a kid way of saying that. And
right.
he just can't. You can tell by his body language. He's just you and I, and he's 15.
Yeah,
Those are the people you really have to pass on the favor to, because I had a lot of it when I was that age. I mean, the guys were so nice and so patient with me. Yes. Yep.
Yeah. So you've got a very focused interest on certain makes and models. You're a Jaguar, Austin Healey, you're a very well-respected expert in those two particular makes, as well as Packard. What really revs you up about, sorry for the pun, about those particular cars?
Well, Kevin, it took a long time to focus in a little bit. When I was younger, I just really liked a wide variety of cars. I loved muscle cars. I loved post-war sports cars, British sports cars particularly. And I really loved the big American classics, too, the pre-war American cars, the big heavy stuff, low production, sort of specially built stuff.
Right.
So I think performance and quality of build. And you can make an argument that Jaguar's build quality wasn't as high as people would want it to be. But it's an interesting balance. You know, when they built those cars, they built them to a price, and they were able to build, you know, something like 70,000 of them, which is a huge number, over 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And they shifted a lot of that responsibility to the owner, to maintain the car. Yeah,
right.
you have to disconnect the electrical connections about every 2 or 3 years and clean them and put a little grease on them and put them back together. And if you're not willing to do that, the car is going to bite you. And if you don't like doing that, you probably should do something else and not have an E-Type. but maybe you never had a knucklehead that would tell you that straight up, so you got into an E-Type.
Well, and that kind of fosters the rumor or the reputation, if you will, of Jaguars having faulty electrical systems. It's just like anything else. It just requires a little bit of love, right?
Well, sure. And the whole reputation is just the herd mentality, because really there's really not much fact to that when you think about it.
Right.
Look at those electrical components. They are infinitely disassemblable. You can take a wiper motor to 75 parts, clean every one of them, put it back together, and the thing's going to work great, even though it's been underwater for 2 years. It's beautiful. You know, if Lucas didn't have its act together, I don't think they'd be wiring the space shuttles.
Yeah, truly. You know? Good point.
So, but when you put complicated machinery that really warrants and asks for a certain amount of maintenance in the hands of a bunch of ham-fisted idiots, of course it's not going to perform well. it's not going to perform well at all. In fact, you're going to have so many people complaining that your product is going to get a reputation. you know, it's taking a Beretta handgun and throwing it in the mud and then complaining that it doesn't shoot well.
So what you're illustrating to me and everybody listening, and by the way, you're listening to Shop Talk, and we're talking with Mark Lambert of Lambert's Garage in Nashville, Tennessee. What you're telling me is basically you're illustrating the difference between a mechanic and a parts changer. And a mechanic is somebody that can diagnose, think their way through something, look at something objectively and not emotionally, and consummate in a repair with success. And it just is, that's a different philosophy today. You know, most of your modern repair shops are, you know, they're components that are removed with the new component stuck on top of it. And arguably that's how auto body repair is anymore. There's very few panel beaters because the cars are just different. But what you're talking about kind of goes back to what we spoke about a little while ago in the value of somebody that understands and is willing to go through the learning curve of training themselves like you did to be that expert. And therein lies the difference. In my mind, anyway.
Exactly. I think you're exactly right, Kevin. I also think the most important aspect of repair is the strategy and the mental part that you do up front. It's primary. The secondary part is actually doing the work. Mm-hmm. You have to have a strategy and you have to know why. And in order to do that, you need to know a couple of key things. First, you need to know how the stuff originally worked, how the system fits into the other systems on the car. And I'll give some examples. And it would help a lot to know where that particular technology falls in the better than a century now of technological advancement.
Mm-hmm.
That's key also, because you have to understand and I think have an approach that is consistent with the technology that's on the vehicle in order to have that sort of authenticity in the vehicle and the experience. Let me give you an example. I'll get a call. This call happens about once a year. Somebody will call and say, oh, I've just had it with this car. I put 3 batteries in it, 2 generators, a voltage regulator. I can't believe it. It's attacking me. It just doesn't like me. <You know? laughs> I said, well, you know, what you're doing is you're just chasing your tail. Of course you had a bad battery because the voltage regulator was bad. And it fried the battery. And you replaced the battery, and then the voltage regulator just hung all the way shut. And it was just charging full blast, and it wasted the generator and the second battery. So let's try to understand the entire system. The battery has a function. The voltage regulator has a function, the wiring, and the generator. So I say that to illustrate, if you know personally the entire system of that repair, you can only be successful. If mm-hmm. you know it, and then you can accomplish the physical side, you'll be successful. And I can also tell you the time it takes to learn it and to understand it and to get confidence and to repair it is a tiny, tiny fraction of the lifetime of frustration that you're going to endure by trusting this stuff to other people. Because you've got to take your car to some knucklehead, and then he's going to forget all about you till Wednesday, and he's going to forget that he was supposed to have the car ready Monday, and then he's going to fix it wrong. All this other, you know, this nonsense. Mm-hmm. I grew up hearing this one phrase: why pay somebody to mess it up when you can mess it up yourself just as well? And it's free.
I like it.
You know, of course, that was said with a big smile and sometimes a slap on the back and saying, you know, look, if you get into trouble, I'll come out and bail you out. And if it's beyond my ability, this is my dad talking, well, hire somebody that really knows it. But it's not going down to the Shell station, because that's just letting you off the hook. Plus, you worked hard on your paper route for that money, and you're not going to waste it on that car paying somebody else to work on it. You're working on it.
Yep, exactly.
And that's the kind of language that really is helpful.
I think that philosophy and that analogy is what made you such a good TV host and such a good instructor on classic car restoration. I really enjoyed watching you. Before I knew you, I enjoyed watching your program and watching you go through the systems and the little models that you made, the desktop model that you made with the charging system on that that 120 Packard. It was very, very well done. And I know that was your concept. I know we all have producers on our television shows, but in a case like that, I'm sure the producer was relying on you to create that analogy in a teachable format. So I just want to say out loud, thanks for being so good at explaining stuff.
Well, gosh, thank you for saying that and for observing it, Kevin. It's sort of secondary in nature. I don't really think about it, but I guess in a sense I'm just passing it on. I was around people that thought it was important to understand and to explain everything about what's going to happen next before we took the step. And that was in the pool. How are we going to swim this distance? What's our strategy going to be? How high are your elbows going to be? What are your splits going to be? What's your goal? From a very early time, you know, how are you going to get that paper route delivered? It's 4:30 in the morning and you've got 106 papers and it's 20 degrees outside. How are you going to do that? Well, I'm going to drive.
Yeah.
Well, I'm 13. I don't have a license, but I'm going to drive because, you know, I know how to drive. You taught me how to drive and I'm just going to do this. So you just do it. Of course, that was another time and a place that was very forgiving, the country,
right,
essentially, on the north side of Indianapolis. But these are the kind of things you look back on and you just think, gosh, how lucky can a person get? I was so lucky to be in that particular set of events and those elements to learn at a pretty early age how easy things are. If you just look at them logically.
We're doing something new with the Shop Talk. We're asking people to email in questions and the things that are maybe bugging them or things that they want resolved. So we've got a question in, and Mark, please feel free to help me answer this. This is from a fellow named David Poulter. He's down in Dothan, Alabama. David's a DIY guy, like a lot of us are, and he's helping restore his grandfather's 37 Chevrolet back to original.
Oh, wow.
They want to do... Ah, beautiful car, the iconic lines. But they want to do a traditional job. He doesn't want to street rod this thing. He wants it to look like it did in the back of his mind and also when he first saw it. He wants that look to the paint. So his question is, what type of paint will closest match the original sheen on that car? And this is an important question because a lot of guys get disappointed in the way the modern paint systems look. They're very different than they used to be, than the old lacquer systems, even the old enamel systems. The base coat, clear coat, urethanes almost have a plasticky tone to them, don't they?
They do. You can get around that, I think. And of course, this is absurd with me offering an opinion in this particular conversation because you can just run circles around me on this, Kevin, but I know how I do this. I would probably have a discussion and sway the customer away from a base coat, clear coat. It can be done, but I think this one, I know those colors. I know those mid-30s General Motors colors. I think this one is probably best served on a urethane with a hardener in it and just polished down a little bit.
That hyper gloss accentuates flaws in the body, and you know as well as I do that an original car, like a survivor car, fit and finish and the quality of the surface of the panels, unless you're getting into your Cadillacs and your Duesenbergs, the I'm not going to say the craftsmanship wasn't very good. It was just different. The standards were different. So a high gloss finish like that is going to accentuate things that a lacquer finish would not, because it's a more subdued sheen and it's a subtle shine rather than a superior gloss. And
yeah.
And in my opinion, I think this guy should either go back with an enamel with a urethane hardener, or like you say, a true polyurethane, and you know, cut it a little bit, and you can mute it down with compounds and things like that, and create the look of a rubbed lacquer finish with 10 times the durability and a whole lot more ease in refinishing. Because he was kind of going towards, do I get lacquer? Well, you know as well as I do, Mark,
yeah,
there are very
yeah.
few sources for original lacquer paints anymore at all. And then you got to know how to use them, and then you got to have the right reducers.
And the quality is lousy today, unfortunately. That wasn't the case 35 years ago, but today it's lousy. I think the most control that this restorer can achieve on this is going ahead and shooting the hardener and the paint, of course, shooting mm-hmm. the job, and then dyeing it down to the level that he wants with compound and abrasives. Because mm-hmm. you can go either way. If you go too far, you can bring it back up. Just get the material on correctly. That's probably the most important thing on this job, is to build up the substrates in such a way that you've got a lot of tooth and a lot of durability, because you're going to be working that paint a little bit to achieve just the right gloss that you want. You know, for some reason I'm envisioning this sort of Brewster green that was so popular on those mm-hmm. 36 and 37 Chevys. It was a great selling color, and also the grays. You know, we were just emerging from the Depression. There were a lot of people buying Chevrolets. 37 was one of their banner years, but when you look at the colors that sold, it's interesting, Kevin, not a lot of the really punchy, bright yellows and reds were selling in the numbers that they sold in 1940 and 41, because people still were feeling the effects of the Depression. And that was just a little too showy. They uh-huh. liked the, of course, black, of course, burgundy, mm-hmm. but they had a really interesting kind of a opalescent gunmetal gray. They had a Brewster green. Those were big selling paint colors. Today, even in the 70s, 80s, 90s, those colors wouldn't sell at all today.
Oh, no. They're fleet colors on
yeah.
today's new vehicle market, for sure. Well, Mark, thanks for your help answering that question. And David, what a great question. Thank you so much for emailing us. And by the way, you can email at shoptalk@eastwood.com and just ask us anything. So for David sending that question in, he gets a $25 discount off his next purchase from Eastwood. So thanks, Eastwood, for that. So keep them coming, guys. And thanks again, Mark, for your help. That kind of brings me to the next topic, and we've sort of touched on this, we've danced around it a little bit. You and I both know that not only the classic and you know, custom car market is changing, but where is it kind of headed? That's the question. What is the future of the automotive restoration? In my mind, I see the trend going towards more of a drivable, enjoyable car rather than a display. And a museum piece. What's your take? I mean, you and I both have different sort of fields of focus. I'm more of a muscle car guy, but I do love the pre-war cars, and your wheelhouse seems to be the pre-war cars, although you love the muscle cars. So in what direction do you see our hobby going, Mark?
Well, there's a couple of different things that we should discuss. The first and the most primary change over the last 25 years or so in the hobby, as it surrounds the pre-war cars. Now, these are the cars that for years looked so different and so good restored that people were very interested in the first two or three generations of the hobby of collecting in the static display, the shows. Shows were such a big deal when I was a kid in the 60s, 70s. That really that was the ultimate goal, just getting onto the show field. There has been such a fundamental shift that today, you know, Kevin, even car clubs are somewhat suffering if they don't involve a strong element of use and touring.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to stand back and you have to wonder what changed. Well, what changed is the guys that were collecting these cars in the 50s, 60s, and 70s were the people that grew up with these cars when they were in service. You know, my dad was into cars all his life, really, but he was at a place where he could buy some old cars and enjoy them in the 60s. Well, he was born in 1924, and he's buying 1930s cars. Well, they were on the road when he was a kid. He saw them in service, and they were all beat up and covered with mud. So it was a big deal for that generation, that sort of second generation of collectors, I like to call it, to see them on the show field. Now, what has changed? Well, those guys have moved on, and they've handed the hobby over to people that were born in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and even later than that now. And those cars are very, very special. And of course, they've sort of made it through the gap. There's none of them are being junked out anymore. They're being coveted and restored and re-restored. And they're also having to earn their living in a collection. Most of my clients today are owners of collections, one or two cars up to maybe 300 cars.
Right.
And it's amazing the shift. They want all of these cars to really run, and they want that authentic experience of driving a car that was made in 1917. They want it to feel like it was made in 1917.
Right, right.
And it has to run on tours, and it has to run all day, and at the end of the day, you shut it down, and there's been no trouble, just like, well, a lot better than it would have been in 1917, because you'd have had four flats. But today the roads are so good, we don't fool with that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And
the next morning it's going to start right up. Well, what I think you're telling me is that the trend is moving towards people enjoying them on a level that is more than observation, that is actually experiencing the vehicle, right?
A much more active approach to the hobby. And what is the outcome of that? That pushes, that massages which cars are important and sought after and which cars aren't so much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, years ago, let's just take a basic car, a Model T Ford. Model Ts were such a huge part of this hobby, and they still are, but not in the same way. The Model T clubs are today, they're touring clubs. They're very active used cars, but they have somewhat compressed in the numbers of people that are participating in that sort of tangent of Model T world. That has changed because they're really 20, 25 mile an hour cars. And that appeal, there's a fantastic appeal to that in a certain mindset. And personally, I completely understand it because I love driving that speed in an old authentic car. But the vast majority of collectors, people in the collector car world, they need a car that's going to move along in traffic. And that's why we saw the phenomenon of the muscle cars happen in the 90s and early 2000s. Not only were they special, not only were they being collected by people that had seen them in service, so there was a direct connection, but they're also very useful. They're fast. You can drive them on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big shift. Most of the stuff that is slow and clumsy, even though it was extremely expensive when it was new, it's not as strong as the stuff that was really drivable and still drivable today.
Right.
For example, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that muscle cars have gone into another iteration of being muscle cars in the sense that there's a huge movement that's about today. It's called pro touring, and it's the emphasis on touring, where groups of guys will get these 60s muscle cars, modernize them with the components such as brakes, modern fuel-injected engines, transmissions, air conditioning systems, and make these cars quite literally into race cars. And And you would think that if you take a late 60s Shelby and change the suspension around, it would devalue the car. But the truth is the industry has responded to this trend in such a way to where not only are a lot of these modifications reversible back to original, but also it enhances the value of the car. I had a friend that just came back from one of the big Barrett Jackson auctions, and he had a beautiful 70 Mach 1, and fully restored car, completely original. It was the big FE, the 428. I think it was a drag pack option. It was fully loaded, and he didn't tell me what it sold for, but he said he made his money back on it, but just barely. Whereas a few cars later, '65 Fastback Mustang that was done pro touring. Really nice car, a nice leather interior, but completely done. It was on a new Art Morrison chassis with modern dual overhead cam fuel injected supercharged engine. The thing went for $132,000 across the block.
Wow.
And a 65 Fastback, not a K code, not a GT 4-speed car, just a Fastback. But the fact that it was outfitted in this pro touring manner, it's today anyway, it's huge draw for people, and to me it speaks volumes as to how people are enjoying classic cars anymore. I mean, you and I know a different definition of classic cars. Classic typically means pre-war, but in the mind's eye of most people today, classic means antique. And I don't want to, you know, get into a debate over terminology because everybody has their own interpretation. But wouldn't you say that is kind of a trend across the board where people want a tangible enjoyment out of their cars? Some way more than others, but very
much so. Yeah, and everything you've just described underscores the fact that we're here to serve the market, and the market mm-hmm. is moving in such a phenomenal and unstoppable way in that direction, that these people that do these, and you stressed very importantly, reversible sorts of restorations, but making the car more friendly to the mass market today, doing that enhances the value of the car. There's no better proof that you have served the entire system at hand correctly when the market rewards you.
Mm-hmm.
You've done a correct job on it. Now,
yeah.
it may be different in 10 years, but right now, today, when somebody gives you a lot of money for your car, you did the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, the whole Gymkhana thing, the autocross thing, guys, it's really hot right now with all the good guys car shows and the franchised car shows, but it's nothing new, is it?
No, that stuff, it has just grown to phenomenal levels. That was always an active part of the collector car hobby. Even when I was a kid, I'd run Gymkhanas in my 1954 TF.
Yeah,
that's back when people did things like that in that car. It wouldn't even be, it'd just be a laugh today. It wouldn't be competitive at all. But that's a big part of the hobby, the enjoyment and the active, to actively engage in owning the car in a way that really, sort of pays its way. Because these cars, you can do that on the weekend and still use them during the week.
And isn't there a big tour that precedes every Pebble Beach? I'm going to start that again. Isn't there a giant tour that precedes every Pebble Beach Concours that for all the discard? Isn't it like up the Pacific Coast Highway or something like that?
Yes, you're right, Kevin. Actually, there's two, and this is a phenomenon that we discussed a little while ago. The change in the collector car world has really been driven in some ways by the Concours world. That's the high end show that used to just be on Sunday afternoon, but now it's a 3-day weekend, or Pebble Beach, it's a full week, because mm-hmm. there are tours and there are active things taking place. Yeah, the Pebble Beach tour generally runs down the West Coast from Washington State and ends up several hundred miles in Carmel, and then there's a tour on Thursday where it's a 75-mile tour. That's an abbreviated tour for the cars that will be on the show field if their owners so determined they want to do that. And today we've got about a 97% participation rate on that tour, which really kind of makes it null, because in the old days that was the tiebreaker, if a particular car had gone on the tour or not. In other words, you reward a person for using the car. And now there's such a high participation rate. It is such a popular event. It's no longer used very often as a tiebreaker. But, you know, the Pebble Beach and Concours and the rest of the Concours world has changed a lot, also more to an active kind of an event. It's a very misunderstood event, I find, by a lot of guys in the hobby that, you know, I kind of think should know better. They still think that Pebble Beach is a show of, you know, super clean high-end cars by a bunch of rich guys that don't necessarily know a lot about cars, and you know, it's just so completely contrary to that. You know, we can't give anybody a demerit for using their car. So this whole mythology about going over your car with Q-tips and, gosh, you can't have any oil leaks or grease leaks or anything, it's total nonsense. We encourage use, and that should be done. And, of course, that's a fairly modern approach. I'm talking about today. In the 1970s, it's a big deal to have a fastidiously clean car. But today, they're being driven onto the show field.
And that's a wonderful thing.
Yes, it is. It is. It's one of the most valuable parts, I think, for the future, the recognition that cars need to be used, no matter what their value is. They're always better served if they're used.
Absolutely. It's just like an old house or a property that you don't, or a vacation home. You got to get in there and you got to live it. You have to have the water running. You've got to cycle the fluids in a vehicle. You have to live in that thing in order for it not to deteriorate, whether it gets used or not. And what a wonderful way to preserve cars while getting an insane amount of enjoyment out of them. And I think it's just a fantastic and apparently it's not a change in the hobby. It's just been sort of adopted by maybe more of these car owners.
But I think it is one of the most valuable contributions that Pebble Beach and the rest of the Concours have made toward the hobby. Just inestimable contribution for the future. Another contribution that comes to mind is the recognition of originality and authenticity versus restoration. Now, we hear a lot about this today. There's a lot of talk about preservation today. Well, you have to take a good long look at what you're preserving if you choose to preserve. Because there's a difference between a car that can sort of make an argument to be preserved and just simply a neglected barn find car. You know, if the seat stuffing's coming out and the leather is almost completely shredded, there's nothing there to preserve. So to make an argument that you have a preservation car and you're not spending any time or money or energy on it because you want to preserve it, it's just a worn out car. In order to function correctly, you should probably go ahead and do that. Now, in the same breath, I'll tell you that back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, there were a lot of cars that were totally destroyed because they were restored and they really didn't need it.
Right.
That could have been, and this is what you do every day. You look at paint from the standpoint of substrate and surface and see how much you can do with what's there. And I've seen you absolutely work wonders on original paint and old paint. And that's the stuff that really excites me, when you can preserve a car and really keep it original.
The saying is they're only original once, and it's an absolute truth. And it's interesting that you bring up the point of there's a tipping point between when one needs restored and when one should be preserved. And I guess that's somewhat in the eye of the beholder, but you being a judge at these Pebble Beach events, you have a lot closer insight than a lot of people would as to maybe where that tipping point is. So as far as a paint job, let me ask you this. Let's get a barn find out. Let's hose the dust off of it. The paint is, well, on some of the leading edges, it's been polished through, but all in all, it's in decent shape. There's a couple of chips and flakes here and there. Should I paint that car, or should I try and polish that up? And should I even touch up the chips? What's the deciding factor? And, of course, the provenance of the vehicle and the value of it, I guess, factors in. But is there a... I don't know. Maybe it's a tough question to answer, Mark, but is there a point to where there's a point of diminished returns on saving one?
Well, I think so, Kevin. Let me wait while that goes by. Well, I think so, Kevin, because you can just follow logic in this decision. Keep in mind that judging at the conqueror's level generally involves decisions where judges can't offer any kind of demerit for use, for signs of use. We only can give a demerit for signs of neglect. So you just pulled your barn find out, and obviously it's been neglected. It's got 2 inches of dust on it. Now, what can we save? What can we reverse? Well, once we hose it off, we decide that overall, standing back, the paint's not too bad, and a large portion of it would shine up, but we've got the leading edges of the fenders through into the primer and through to the bare steel, and it's already rusting. And then we've got some rust in the rocker panels, and we've got rust in the floorboards. Well, I can deal with some of that separately, but a lot of it's going to bump right up against the paint. So what am I going to do? What am I trying to preserve?
Right.
Well, if it's a 507 BMW or a 300 SL Mercedes or a an AC Alpha, that makes a whole different argument. You want to preserve some of that stuff, road racing damage and so forth, as the history of the car. But I think we're talking about normal production cars here.
Right.
And I think the tipping point is fairly early in a car like that. You know, we just pulled a 68 GTO out of a barn, and it's a really cool-looking coupe, and it's, it's dark green with a black vinyl top and a black vinyl interior. And after we hose it off, we find that the top looks pretty good overall, but all back around the back deck and the back window, it's all rusted under there because the top came up and the water got in.
Right.
And the rust is going down into the trunk. But, overall, the paint looks pretty good. So I think the proper approach to that car would be to reach for, you may not be able to achieve it, but to reach for preserving that final top. If it hasn't really been shredded or neglected too much, you might be able to heat gun it and save it, fold it back, do all the metal work, and then match the paint. Put as little paint on the car as possible. Just blend it. And again, it's just going to be a hardened urethane. You're not going to be able to clear coat anything. Just blend it in. I think that's an approach to that car, because then you can be confident in saying that, 80% of this car is what GM shot on.
And that's a saying that I hear a lot more lately. This is 80% original paint, or 90% of the paint is original. And I don't know. That's a great way to look at it. And that eventually can save somebody a whole lot of money. Because like you say, to invest in someone else doing a paint job for you, the numbers start ringing up significantly quickly. So to do a spot job on a car like that, man, you can get out and drive it in 2 months rather than
weeks.
2 years.
Yes,
exactly.
And you're not taking doors and glass and everything else apart. Mm-hmm. The other important thing that we should bring up is what does that look like for the future? What's going to happen? If we can predict the future or try, what can we do? What facts do we know that can lead us to some sort of decision? Well, that decision is going to be totally consistent with what we just discussed. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at other realms of collecting, let's look at fine furniture and musical instruments. You know so much about musical instruments that it is second nature to you to observe the originality of a wooden instrument, a guitar, in original finish. Well,
absolutely.
The car collecting is, we're about 150 years behind those people.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Fine
okay.
firearms, fine furniture. I mean, they've been collecting those things since 1750.
Right, right.
And,
somebody polishes the patina off of a Tiffany lamp,
it decreases
the value like crazy. So
it's
the same thing with the bluing on a vintage weapon or that patina, that cracked lacquer on an old Martin guitar.
Right.
You're exactly right, Mark.
So the person today that makes that decision to put out that different sort of effort, it's a lot of effort, but it's a different kind of effort. He's going to get dividends right up front. He's going to get a car that he can use sooner. He can have a more authentic feel and experience while he has the car. But, you know, years later, perhaps in his estate, or somebody else's ownership, years later, it's a much more valuable car. Because
all the
other guys that bought 68 GTOs, like myself, I bought one in 72 with my brother. I still have it. We're like a bunch of knuckleheads. We painted the car in our driveway. It didn't need paint, but it was dark green, and I wanted a red car because that was my school colors.
Yeah.
And, you know, the red paint's peeling off, and there's beautiful green paint under it today.
Isn't it interesting that you and I are sitting here talking about it and giving our best advice to people about their classic cars, saying, leave them alone. You and I are in the restoration industry. We're telling people to leave them alone.
Yeah, for goodness sake, don't restore it. Well, there's an infinite there are infinite number of different approaches to restoration. Really, restoration is just, I like to think of it as bringing a car back to where it was when it was freshly in service. I'm going to say 2, 3, 4, 5 years old. It's the kind of car, it's a 55 T-Bird that you would see on a car lot in 1959.
Right.
You know, it's got 50,000 miles on it.
But
it's really serviceable. It's really just right. And that's sort of what I like to think of in some of these projects that we're trying to achieve. Other projects, you know, absolutely, we're doing a full-blown restoration on the car because it needs everything. Or that's what we've decided with the customer as the strategy. But so often the owner and everybody down the line can be much better served by a very, very logical and forthright approach to a restoration. You're still doing a lot of work.
Yeah.
It just may not come to my shop or to your shop. We kind of hope it stays home with the person that is going to do as much work as they possibly can before they have to come to your shop or my shop. And then if and when that happens, we'll step right up and we're the guys that can help you. But I am so into this do-it-yourself approach to it. That's what really excites me. I think at the end of the day, nothing is more exciting than seeing these guys bring these cars by the shop month after month, saying, here's what I did last month, and now I'm here and I'm stuck on this. You know, this clutch is making a really funny noise. What do you make of this? I probably spend 2 hours a day on that kind of stuff. That's so much more fun to see those guys coming around in their teens and 20s and early 30s really gaining this knowledge.
Well, it's empowering. It's self-empowering. And people get a tangible joy from it, which is – that's the whole idea. You know, and to empower somebody to say, yes, I did that myself. It's my mission. It is truly my mission in my professional life to try and empower and inspire people to – to take it on by the horns and fail a couple times before you succeed, but eventually you're going to succeed. And,
oh,
and
yes.
You're telling me the same thing. And you know, so you as a restorer, you get as much joy as your customer or your client does out of creating a success for themselves. And it's, I don't know, man, that's probably the nucleus of this great brotherhood that we both experience, that everybody experiences in this hobby, and it's commonality, it's common ground, and I'm right there with you, Mark. The DIY thing, doing it yourself, empowering yourself, it creates that experience and draws like-minded people around you, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful thing.
It does, and it's a fantastic approach to life, completely away from cars. It is such a success oriented approach. You grab life. I had a guy tell me one time when I was being a little bit hesitant to go into this Wilson Preselector gearbox of the early 30s. This is a Preselector racing gearbox. I don't know if you know about these things, Kevin, but it was an amazing change in the continuum of gearboxes toward automatics. A Wilson Preselector box is neat because you pre-select the gear without doing anything with what you and I would know as the clutch pedal. Let's say we're at the end of a long straightaway and we're in fourth gear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can pre-select third gear halfway down the straightaway, and I'm still all the way on the power.
Right.
And I let off, go through the turn, and then I'm back on the power flat out, and I dip the clutch in and out, bang.
Yeah.
And it shoves it into third gear. So the guy beside me with an old conventional four-speed, he's had to clutch in, maybe double clutch down the third gear. Well,
yeah.
I just blow him away.
Exactly.
And then my fourth gear shift up to fourth again, because I'm into a straightaway again. I'm flat out on the floor in third gear. I pre-select fourth. And when mm-hmm. I want fourth, I just bang the clutch in and out, and it gives me fourth. And I catapult ahead of this guy. That's a Wilson
yeah.
Pre-selector box. They
okay,
came about in the early 30s. So
I'm
it's complicated.
Cool.
And, you know, I'm really hesitant to go into it because I think I'm going to screw it up. And this guy, a very good friend, says, Lambert, you know, quit messing around. He was an Englishman. He said, quit messing about with it. Grab it by the throat and throw it on the ground and stomp on it and show it who's boss. You know, you do that actively.
Uh-huh.
You stand back, you listen, you learn, but there's a time in life when you have to act. And you act in a very an oriented way toward result. And you're going to get through life with a lot of success. You make it count when action is called for. You achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Don't be afraid of it because you can all if you goof it up, you can always call Kevin.
Exactly, or you can call Mark, and we'll get you out of trouble.
That's our job.
I'm going to get T-shirts printed up, Mark. I've got a new slogan. It's just very simple. Do the work. I'm going to have
yeah.
T-shirts made with Paintrication. Do the work. And that's something that I love it, too. And that's it's a simple mission statement, and I want to encourage as many people as I possibly can to do that. And I know you do as well. And I just want to thank you for spending time with us you know, sharing your philosophy is really neat to get your insight, Mark, always. And there's stuff that we've talked about on this interview in Shop Talk that you and I have never had the chance to even broach the subject of. So I'm thrilled with our conversation. But I wanted to ask you, is there anybody that you'd like to thank, any mentors that have helped you coming up in your career, or anybody that you want to give a shout-out to?
Oh, gosh. You know, there are so many people that have just been – exactly perfectly timed in my career. I've got a shout out to the Sparks family, you know,
mm-hmm.
Tom
yeah.
Sparks, fantastic guy. I know you know who Tom was, and he's no longer with us, but boy, he's sure here in spirit in the collector car world. He's very much a part of that. Tom's a guy that would reach out and help just about anybody that really didn't hack him off in a way that was so far beyond what you would expect. I mean, he's just such a humble guy and quiet, but really, really very efficient in the way he was able to reach so many people and help them. So, the Sparks family have been so good to so many people. But my thank yous would go all the way back to my days in Indianapolis here with my customers. You know, it's such a great achievement, I think, to go through this hobby, this collector car world, and just connect with so many fantastic people that want this work done, and they're as focused as we are. So my customers, I think, I owe a great debt of gratitude to for understanding that this is not easy work. It takes some patience, it takes some real energy and some real money to make it happen. But they all seem to be so thrilled, really, when the day comes and the car rolls out of here and it's correct. And I know you know what I'm talking about.
I do. I do know. Yes. And there's to be a part of that of helping someone achieve that is it's very humbling to me, and it's an honor. And obviously, you take it very seriously too.
Yes, I do. And I think the observance of all the people over the years, really, it comes in every day in this work. You're always using the things that you've learned that were given generously by other people when you needed them, and when you asked for it, you looked like you needed them. So, I think my thank you would go to more generally the folks that have been around since the early days of my business. I still have customers today that I've been with for almost 30 years now.
That's nice. So they're almost like family members. That's cool.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I've had customers through the years that I have keys to their garage and their cars, and you know, they spend so much time on the road, they just say, go get the car and do it. And you really feel like you're getting to know them in a way that, you know, the guy at the laundromat or the cleaners doesn't know them this well. You know, it's a very intimate relationship between a restorer and his customer, and that's something that trips up a lot of guys. They really don't always understand that it's an extremely important and fragile relationship in the early stages, and then after a while it becomes like granite. It is very, very strong. It's just rock solid if you always make the consistent approach. Is you're the very best job you can do, and would I do this if it were my car? That's the acid
right.
test.
Yeah, exactly. Well, very good. That's excellent philosophy, my friend, and thank you again so much for sharing your time with me and everybody listening here on Shop Talk. And I just want to thank you for being so forthright with not only your advice to everybody listening today, but with your sharing of information with me. It's meant a lot to me, Mark, and I'm humbled and proud to call you a friend. So thank you, man.
Thank you, Kevin. It's been a real pleasure being with you on Shop Talk here. And thanks to everybody at Eastwood, too. I use that stuff every day in my shop. Nobody asked me to say that. It's just the best stuff, and that's where I go. And thank you so much to all your listeners out there, all you guys out there that are just coming in, or you've been in this collector hobby for a long time. It doesn't matter. It's just you're the guys that really make this whole thing go. You're the entire wheel of this whole thing. So I just want to thank you for your interest and your continued support. And just get out there and really have a great time with your cars.
Well said. We've been talking with Mark Lambert from Lambert's Garage here in Nashville, Tennessee, and you're listening to Shop Talk. We're brought to you by the Eastwood Company. Remember, do the job right with Eastwood. Hey, and email in those questions because you get a pretty healthy discount. We'll talk to you guys soon.
Mark is one of those guys that inspires just by being in his field of energy, and he has earned the accolades he's received. And trust me, the hobby is better for guys like him being in it. So we thank him for taking the time and sharing his thoughts and knowledge with us. We've got lots more great guests coming up this season on Shop Talk, so keep listening and keep on doing the job right with Eastwood. Now go out and get those hands dirty. Check out everything at the Eastwood.com website. Eastwood has what it takes to do the job right. And you know me, I like to do the job right. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk. I'm Kevin Tates.